ladies and gentlemen, from the Eastwood Show. It's the show that's all about genocide and scumbaggery and laughing at it, because if you don't, you'll go absolutely, completely and utterly insane. Oh, yeah. Broadcasting live 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And my very special guest right at this moment is Brian Strom. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinny. How you doing?
Yeah, somewhat fabulous is my standard response.
Thanks for having me on your show.
You're welcome, mate. Now, you're a bit of an inventor yourself, aren't you?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I hold patents on specialized type of advanced DC generators. It uses standard induction, but in a radical new geometry. I spent about
what exactly is a DC generator? Is it something that politicians use in the Washington Monument or something?
Yeah, maybe they should. Well, it could be an AC generator as well. It's an induction type generator. I prefer the DC embodiment to the AC embodiment. It's going to be more efficient. An AC version could be built, and it would be an extremely high efficiency generator, beyond what is typically considered 100%.
You know, I think you could probably do an ad for that and have a theme song from maybe AC/DC.
Right. They were onto something.
So, yeah. So what exactly are you generating? How does it work? You know, pretend that I know nothing. Actually, don't pretend.
Well, most generators built in the 20th century, of course, are AC-type induction generators, mostly developed by Nikola Tesla. Edison later, glommed onto his technologies and distributed them, and with the help of, Morgan, developed the AC industries here in the United States, leading also around the world. But those induction generators have a cap of efficiency, and it's based on what's called Lenz's law, or the law that basically regulates through those machines the transfer of mechanical energy in terms of rotating torque, velocity and torque of rotation, into electricity. And they're capped by Lenz's law, which is a law which I spent more than a decade researching to identify its weaknesses, essentially. Then through the result of that research, I've come across designs of generators built in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and I met with several of those inventors. Adam Trombley, I spent a number of hundreds of hours with personally, actually. Met him at a free energy conference in Hanover, West Germany in 1988, where he was a keynote speaker. At that conference, there was literally about a dozen devices that all claimed to be over 100% efficient. I'd say 80% of those devices were in the field of frictional heaters and anomalous heating units that produce more heat than they were supposed to through the conventional wisdom. So, I attended that conference then. I met Adam Trombley there, and he took me into the area of his research, which was that of the unipolar generator. The unipolar generator is the simplest known generator. It's been known about since Michael Faraday himself in 1871, I think it was. He built a type of Faraday disc and experimented in his notes with versions of the unipolar generator. Now, the unipolar generator is simply a magnetic disk or sphere that's spinning on its axis of magnetization. It's exactly the same as the Earth itself. The Earth has a magnetic field that is essentially along its line of axis of rotation, and it spins in the presence of its own field. This presents a lot of kind of problems to orthodox physicists. A lot of them want to say that this won't even work because there's no relative motion between the rotor and the field source. And the reality is it does work. It works very well. It's been identified in the American Journal of Physics and other technical references. And the one-piece generator is a reality. And you can spin a disk that supplies its own magnetic field in the presence of its own field and generate a voltage from it, and current, and quite a lot of current, actually. So I hope that wasn't too technical or stuff, but I'll go along with that if you like.
Keep going, man. Keep going.
Well, okay. So the unipolar generator is based on the geometry and magnetism of the Earth itself, and it's to a great respect. It forces a lot of thought into how does this really happen, and the devices I've built that prove out this philosophy and theory is that the magnet itself, a permanent magnet, is just like an optical lens. It's like a lens in the respect that when you look through a lens, you see an image on the other side. But if you rotate the lens on its axis of focus, the image that you see does not rotate. Just the lens rotates in its own focal paradigm or, you know, event. And so when a magnet, similarly, is rotated on its axis of field, assuming you've got, a symmetrical disc-shaped or cylindrical magnet that's magnetized down the length of its geometry with symmetry, all around, and it's spinning on that same symmetrical axis of field, the field doesn't rotate. And so the objects that are spinning around in that field are essentially moving through the field are getting induced to have a polarity just by virtue of spinning in the presence of its own field. And it's just the same amount of induction as occurs in all the other AC, Tesla-type generators and even, DC motors and generators. But it's a different geometry than is typically taught or accepted, acknowledged. These generators, versions of them have been around in industry for a long time. A homopolar generator is slightly different from a unipolar generator in that a homopolar generator has a fixed field source and a disk or inductor rotating in front of it. So there is a relative motion between the two objects in a homopolar generator. And my designs are a combination of those two events. I've got two counter-rotating disks spinning in the presence of a common field that's also aligned with the axis of rotation. There's no interference with it. I built
so it's kind of.
I'm sorry.
Is it by chance similar to the way a flying saucer is supposed to work with a spinning disc, and it creates a magnetic field and it allows it to kind of push through and move around space with no G-force kind of thing?
Well, sort of, yes. I found some interesting references that do correlate the geometries. There was a famous or infamous, if you will, inventor in England in the 1970s named John Searle, and built a thing called the Searle disc that was apparently a magnetized disc that he'd spin at a high rate of speed, and in smaller models of it, it would levitate off the ground, turn blue, luminous blue, and then disappear on its own. And then he supposedly built a large model of this that you could get inside. And so I couldn't find that many details on John Searle and his work, but there were similarities in some of the devices I heard he tested. And there is a kind of runaway effect that occurs with the unipolar and homopolar generators.
If you were using that to perhaps generate electricity, wouldn't you worry that, your generator might just up and disappear one day?
Well, yeah, that would be a challenge. Yeah.
It's like, dude, the power's out. Go check the generator. It's gone.
Well, I don't want to build, my goal is not to build something that has any runaway type effect or is in any way harmful either. My goal is simply to build a better generator, if you will, better mousetrap, one that utilizes induction, but it also utilizes these new high-tech rare earth permanent magnets, which are fairly available. The magnet technology of the neodymium magnets was invented here in Indiana, where I'm from, through a joint venture between General Motors Corporation and the Chinese government. And that was in a company called MagnaQuench that they have since dismantled and swept under the rug. GM fought China on the rights to those magnets and lost. And basically China sells them to whoever they want to. They mine most of the neodymium in the world anyway and control basically the whole market on those magnets.
There's actually a place here in New Zealand where they've got where they sell neodymium and magnets there, and they have this the steel grate on the floor that's held to the floor just with one little neodymium magnet. And if you can manage to move the grate at all, you get like $1,000 or something like that. Nobody's been able to move it.
Well, yeah, I'm still working with some that are about 10 years old, and they've got about an 800-pound force of attraction between a couple of them. But I know that now they can make them probably about twice that strong, like up to 60. I think they have an N60 these days, which is just incredible material, space-age material, that they can hold that level of field, you know, and retain stability. The instable part of the neodymiums is that they can't hold temperature. If you heat them up, even to the point of boiling water, they'll lose almost all their field.
Is that about the weakness of them?
That's one of the greatest weaknesses, yeah, to them, is temperature.
Okay. Well, maybe if I go down to that place who has the neodymium thing and pour some boiling water on that magnet, then try and move it, I could be $1,000 richer.
There you go. Take some boiling hot coffee and spill it on the sheet.
There you go. Oops!
And it would demagnetize it, yeah, right quickly.
All right. There's a money-making venture. Thank you. Suss that out after the show. I've also got to ask as well, in layman's terms, how exactly do these devices work, and how much energy are they really generating? I mean, how big is it? Could you power a house on it? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, eventually, yes. That's the goal, is to build, you know, larger scale devices. Now, the prototypes I work with, I've got a 4.5-inch diameter rotor right now. I'm moving my next prototypes to go up to a 6-inch diameter neodymium magnet, which has got a lot of field strength, you know, and it's going to easily produce as much power as that of a car battery. And that's sort of the equivalent I'm shooting for, something about 12 volts DC. At about 100 amps continuous, available. And the machine, the way it would operate in an ideal embodiment, it would have a computer control system, and it needs a starter motor, too, because it doesn't do anything while it's sitting still, so you have to spin it up to speed, at which point you have to put a load on it, electric load, which excites the coils in it, where they actually attract each other, and will develop additional torque under an electric load, which is contrary to that which is taught in physics and textbooks, that, of course, if you put electric load on a normal generator, it creates a braking force inside the generator, which slows it down. And in mine, I've got two field sources set up in a tangential arrangement where when a load is put on them, the resultant fields are an attraction to each other. It's a redesign of these systems, and one which may actually produce a usable torque and power simultaneously. But the electric load would have to be computer controlled, and the velocity of the machine would have to be regulated by a little piggyback control system.
Okay, so yeah, you kind of didn't answer my question, but how big is it, and what could you run off? I mean, like in an ideal world, let's say you get all the designs and all the kinks worked out, what would you really be looking at producing? Because what I'd really love to have is a portable generator that kind of runs on its own. You don't need to refuel it, don't need to recharge it or anything like that. And you can just basically bring it anywhere. You can power a campsite, or you can just plug it into the mains power of your house and power that, and sell power back to the grid if you want to. Is it anything like that?
Very, very nice. Yes. Yeah, so in an ideal world, you know, at the 6-inch diameter rotor, it's going to fit inside basically kind of a car battery is what, about 12 inches by 6 or 7 inches by 7 or 8 inches or so, right? So it should fit inside. It should be actually smaller than a car battery, lighter than a car battery, produce the same output as a car battery. In these earlier embodiments. Now, maybe there could be ways to pack it even more energy dense than that as we go, but in early embodiments, that's what I would shoot for. So to power a house, you probably need one that was about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet.
All right, hold on. Hold it right there. We'll be right back after the break. Just hold on the line. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment today. We've got my very special guest, Brian Strom, who's the inventor of basically kind of free energy technology. Really, welcome back to the show, Brian.
Thank you.
How long have you been doing this?
I started my studies in the mid 1980s, actually. 1988 was a pivotal year. I went to the Hans Kneipper Free Energy Conference in West Germany, and there I met Dr. Adam Trombley, who introduced me to the unipolar technology. It took me long. It's taken, you know, many years, and it's ongoing to get the resources together to build the ongoing prototypes. But I built about 10 or 12 solid devices that just prove or disprove various principles as I progressed.
Now, speaking of principles, have you had any roadblocks that you've been hit into from other people trying to stop you doing your research, or suppression syndrome, any of that kind of stuff going on, or has pretty much everybody just left you alone?
I have made presentations to some larger organizations, especially here in Indiana, including Rose Holman Ventures, which is highly capitalized, and including the Indiana Venture Center, which is a business development incubator, and also to Delco Remy America, which used to make all the alternators and generators for all GM cars. Now they're an independent company, really, doing it for the whole industry, but with competition. Mostly, I would say the forces against me are simply personal forces of maintaining their own jobs or status or the ideas that they have been taught. I go a little further than most people in this area of science. So I could be seen as a threat. You know, I don't think anything directly has come after me, but I'm on my guard.
Well, there's also another element to this, is that people just don't believe that it's even possible, or they just don't understand the science behind it, and therefore they just instantly lose interest and say, oh, it's quackery. Like a friend of mine, we ordered these hydrogen fuel cells online and got them in, installed it in the car ourselves. Worked great, you know, when we were driving in the city, about maybe 10% extra fuel economy, but a massive increase in power to the car. And when driving open road, that's when the fuel economy just went through the roof. You know, we got nearly twice as far as we normally would on a single tank of gas.
And you're adding hydrogen to the gasoline.
Brown's gas, directly into the carburetor, kind of thing.
Brown's gas, yes. Well, I'm very familiar with Brown's gas. It's fantastic.
I met
Yul Brown. I met him and bought two of his machines from him personally. Around 1995.
Well, what was interesting and what I was trying to elaborate on here was that my friend was a mechanic, right? So he was talking to his other mechanic buddies in the shop, and they all said, "Oh, that's dangerous. It'll blow up, or it'll overheat the engine, and this kind of thing." They don't know that it burns cool, kind of thing. They're just basically idiots who don't know what the hell they're talking about, and because they don't know what the hell they're talking about, they don't want to do it.
Right. Brown's gas is counterintuitive, absolutely. It is an implosive gas, not an explosive one, and that aspect alone is very difficult to convey, you know, to other scientists. Yul himself demonstrated to me. He had a bucket, like a 5-gallon bucket, filled with water, and then a coffee can inside there. And he pushed the coffee down and filled all the way up with water, and then turned it upside down and pull it up in the air so it was filled with water. Then he'd take it had a spark igniter on it too, like a grill spark igniter on the bottom of the can, and then he'd fill the can up just with the Brown's gas through a tube underwater. So that you knew that there was just Brown's gas inside that coffee can. And then he'd ignite it, you know, and everyone would think it's hydrogen's going to explode, right? And no, it didn't explode at all. It made a kind of a whoosh-whack sound as it created a vacuum inside the coffee can, and the water slapped up to the top of the can. Remarkable demonstration. Yeah, the Brown's gas is implosive. Yeah.
A friend of mine, John Eisen, in fact, he does this magazine, Uncensored magazine, available if anybody is keen, from uncensored.co.nz. It might be coming into the States and Europe soon. He had a hydrogen cell similar to mine, a little larger, a lot more panels on it. And he accidentally left it running one day, you know, like he had to unhook the battery in order to turn it off, and he forgot. And so this Brown's gas just kept building up and building up and building up, and then he was just sitting inside, you know, working on his computer, and then bang, you know. Oh, my God. And you know, what was surprising is that it didn't cause a fire. It didn't do anything. It was just a little bit of an implosion, and it didn't even damage the cell itself. It just kind of blew out a little bit of a gasket on his car. And that's just because it was building up continuously and wasn't able to release.
Inside the car?
Yeah, into the carburetor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? It doesn't explode, it actually implodes. And Yul also was working, he was right, running his Brown's gas straight into some crude oil, and he was running the crude oil through a closed loop, around in a closed loop, and at one end of the loop he'd put the Brown's gas, mix it with the crude oil, and the other end of the loop he had a piston engine that ran on crude oil, and he could run the same crude oil through the piston engine endlessly just by adding hydrogen to it with the Brown's gas.
I think that there's really a lot to be said for these types of technologies, and what I find really frustrating is that, well, let me put it this way. Somebody questioned whether I was paying some, I forget what it was, I used to be a smoker, right, and somebody criticized me and said, "Oh, you're supporting big tobacco." And I said, "Really? How did you get here?" And they go, "Well, I drove." And I go, "Really? Did you by chance fill your car up at some giant mega death oil corporation on your way here?" "Yeah." "Well, then you're supporting big oil." And you know, it's just the point that just because you don't have a choice, really, And in order to do it yourself requires a lot of time and energy, and people just don't want to do it. It's really strange.
Yeah, they don't. Right. Some people, I think, are fearful of the kind of change and whatnot, you know. So it's going to take probably people just like you and I who, you know, get things going on our own and distribute it, you know, among a small group of people. I mean, that's, we have to at least, you know, distribute the information right now. I mean, I have no fear of discussing my technology openly. I mean, there are some intricacies in the design work which are pretty special. I don't really disclose those, but, you know, otherwise the basic premise of it is public domain, has been for a long time. You know, the new work that's going on in the electric universe, scientific worlds, I believe Thunderbolts.info is a great organization, and they're really promoting, you know, the new beliefs about the electromagnetic universe, you know, to the orthodox community. I've approached them about my technology, and they're still not so receptive to it. You know, they'd actually never even responded because for them, I probably addressed too many issues too fast, and they don't want to hit it that hard. You know, they just want to chip away at the old thing. Whereas I think guys like you and I, we just want to wipe the slate clean and start over again.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm actually inherently a lazy consumer. So I'm being pretty blunt and honest here. What I want, really, is something on the market that I can purchase and have somebody install it for me. And if something goes wrong with it, have somebody maintain it for me, you know, either at a warranty or a small cost or something like that, and conveniently fit it into the consumer model. The difficulty is actually finding people who will be willing to do that. And I don't know, it's really sad. And unfortunately, we've come to the end of the program here, Brian. Do you by chance have a website or anything like that people can visit if they want to read up more?
I appreciate that. Yes, I have a small website presence at magvortex.com. That's magvortex.com. And it has a couple little clips, but it also should have my patent documents and some numerous supporting technical documents and some images of some of my prototypes. I appreciate the time. Thanks for having me on the show, Vinny.
You're welcome, mate. I mean, today's been a very interesting show nonetheless. We've had three people talking about radically different subjects. One about his pigs not being able to be sold and sort of food control and Agenda 21 in the United States. Another guy who's who is able to create rain in Australia. And then we've got you, who's able to create energy out of magnet technology and stuff in the United States. So and on the host from New Zealand. So there we go. This is a nice little variable show for you, ladies and gentlemen. I hope all of you can listen into it a little more regularly because, mate, every single day we've got somebody new on this show, pretty much, all right? So I encourage people to go into those archives at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and if you like it, enjoy it, and please make a donation if you can. We'll see you again sometime.